Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, neuroimmunologist Dr. Grace Gombele of Emory University School of Medicine and Dr. Varun Kannan of the Emory University School of Medicine sit down for a discussion on acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, or ADEM. Together, they provided a practical overview of how clinicians can recognize the disorder, differentiate it from conditions like multiple sclerosis, MOG antibody-associated disease, and NMOSD, and navigate treatment decisions in a rare disease with no FDA-approved therapies. The conversation also explores long-term outcomes, the growing overlap between ADEM and MOGAD, emerging biomarkers that may improve diagnostic precision, and common misconceptions that can complicate diagnosis and management in clinical practice. Let's dive in.
ADEM, as a lot of clinicians know, stands for acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. In short, it's basically an immune reaction against central nervous system tissues following an infection. What we think we understand about the pathophys is that there is almost always an antecedent infection, and it's not the direct infectious invasion of the CNS that causes the disease. It's the immune system's response to the infection. Digging in a little bit deeper, we don't quite know, is it a friendly fire situation related to molecular mimicry, or is this a two-hit situation where there was a previous insult that exposed the immune system to the brain antigens that then just gets triggered by the virus, or is it both? I think the key to approaching the diagnosis is that it's a combination of clinical symptoms and radiographic findings. You have to have, by definition, altered mentation or encephalopathy as part of it, but then you have to correlate that with the MRI findings. Typically, we describe these as white matter predominant lesions. They're poorly demarcated. Sometimes we use unofficially the term fluffy. And this is in contrast to something like multiple sclerosis, where the lesions have a very sharp and defined border. So if you have the combination of clinical symptoms and these radiographic findings, you may very well be dealing with ADEM. There is no specific test that can confirm this. It's kind of putting all the pieces together and making sure they make sense. And equally important, I think, is ruling out other potentially confounding diagnoses like infectious encephalitis, or especially in kids, genetic disorders that might look and react very similarly.
Great. I agree with that. I think the only thing I'd add is just making sure the clinical presentation is encephalopathy, I think, is a really key feature that sometimes people will make a diagnosis for ADEM based on the imaging alone. But just like Dr. Kannan said, making sure that the clinical features meets along with the MRI features makes sense for the diagnosis.
Well, I wanted to go into a little bit more about kind of the diagnostic workup for these patients. Dr. Kannan, you kind of touched upon it a little bit there towards the end of your sentence. So, you know, what are some of the biggest challenges in differentiating ADEM from other conditions that might look like it? There's kind of a lot of other cousins in the sort of autoimmune field. So how do we kind of differentiate this from other disorders, and what sorts of clues will help you guide that distinction in clinical practice?
So yeah, there's several different ways to, when we're doing the diagnostic evaluation. So we talked about imaging already. So imaging features can help you look at it. Dr. Kannan mentioned they're larger fluffy lesions, and we think more along the ADEM, NMOSD, MOGAD arena. They're smaller lesions, more discrete than going to be multiple sclerosis. If there's T1 black holes, as we call it, so on MRI, you can get hypointensity, so areas that look really dark in the white matter, that tends to be more likely MS or multiple sclerosis. And then there's also other things like magnetic rim lesions and things that can help you more point towards MS, for example. And then the central vein sign has become a prominent feature now for diagnosing MS. In the NMOSD MOGAD realm, seeing if you have bilateral optic neuritis, that makes you more likely thinking about NMOSD or MOGAD, and sometimes location of where in the optic nerves or optic tracts can help you, whereas MS tends to be more unilateral. And the reason why this comes up in the ADEM conversation is that ADEM could be the initial presenting feature in any of those three conditions, or looks like something like the imaging can look like ADEM in the first presentation of having MS, MOGAD, or NMOSD, but that's where the evaluation helps. So we send serum antibodies for MOG and aquaporin 4. That will help. And those tend to be more sensitive than CSF, although there's some debate about CSF MOG antibody testing. But generally right now, serum testing is really important. And then in terms of other imaging features, because it takes time for the antibodies to come back. And so sometimes it's hard to know in the very beginning. And so another imaging feature that can be helpful is something that we had looked at here at Emory, is looking at leptomeningeal enhancement. So that's a type of pattern on the MRIs where you have breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, you get some contrast enhancement in leptomeninges. So if you're seeing somebody with demyelination plus leptomeningeal enhancement, you're more likely thinking about MOGAD plus minus ADEM in there, less likely MS and NMOSD. And then finally, the CSF profile can be helpful. So seeing elevated white cell count, depending on how high it is, generally mildly high in the MS group, sort of medium high. We're talking in the 50-ish range for the NMOSD. MOGAD can be a wide range into a few dozen white blood cells to even in the hundreds. So that can help you too. But ADEM I think of ADEM as a Venn diagram where it encompasses MS, NMOSD, and MOGAD. And then there you have seronegative ADEM or ADEM that doesn't fit any of those diagnostic criteria, then those ended up being ADEM in and of itself.
I think something else that helps more in retrospect is that MS lesions stick around forever. And the lesions that we see in ADEM almost always will resolve over time. So that's not necessarily helpful in the moment when you're trying to make the diagnosis, but we're almost always getting follow-up scans anyway. And that kind of helps solidify the diagnosis that we expect clinical improvement to also follow MRI improvement.
Oh, all great, great insights and great pearls that clinicians can take back in their clinical practice. Obviously, there's a lot of crossover between some of these disorders and what they look like and how they initially present. Let's talk a little bit about treatments. Unfortunately, obviously, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is no FDA-approved disease-modifying therapy for ADEM right now, 20-plus approved for multiple sclerosis, and we've seen a lot more improvement in terms of treatments for NMOSD and MOGAD over the last couple of years. But how are treatment decisions typically approached in ADEM, particularly regarding corticosteroids, IVIG, or plasma exchange? Just give a little bit of breakdown of what the treatment paradigm looks like.
Yeah, you're right, Marco. There is no FDA-approved treatment for ADEM. And to be honest, ADEM is kind of a difficult disease category to study. It probably is a syndrome that we are calling one disease, but there may be many different flavors of ADEM. For example, we know that many kids with ADEM actually have underlying MOG antibody disease, but that's not always the case. So I think it's important for us to keep in mind that these are disease categories that we invented to make diagnosis easier for us, but it doesn't mean they always are going to behave the same. It's not a very common disease either. I think the latest updated demographics looked like 1 in 250,000. So rare disease is inherently difficult to study and difficult to design clinical trials for. But what we know about the pathophys, like I talked about at the beginning, is that this is an overactive immune situation. We know that corticosteroids acutely help in the acute attacks of MS and optic neuritis. So we've kind of applied that same logic into the treatment of ADEM. And most of us do see that children and adults with ADEM will respond, hopefully very quickly, to anti-inflammatory treatment. I think it's important to try to initiate treatment early. Of course, priority number one is to make sure that it's safe to start steroids. And the main thing we want to exclude is something like bacterial meningitis, of course. But once you've excluded acute bacterial infection, then I think it is appropriate to start steroids with the IV high dose while we're waiting for the rest of the diagnostics to come back. The decision about IVIG and PLEX kind of depends, I think, a lot on the initial response to steroids, but sometimes also on how sick the patient is. Plasma exchange, especially in children, is basically a form of that anti-inflammatory dialysis. It's very invasive, and it is a pretty serious procedure to do. Kids often require sedation and anesthesia to do it safely. So sometimes we will defer doing that upfront unless the kid is critically ill and it's a life-threatening situation, or if we've tried steroids and they haven't shown a clear improvement. Sometimes we will opt for IVIG instead of plasma exchange, but in reality, we don't have good data that suggests that plasma exchange is definitively superior than IVIG. We're kind of applying other data from different diseases like Guillain-Barré syndrome that suggests that plasma exchange might at least lead to faster improvement in symptoms. Beyond that, we're still not really at a stage where we can confidently say that there is a specific role for certain biologics like we have in MS. We do have some emerging data in MOG antibody disease that we can potentially apply to the treatment of ADEM. For example, we know that one of the chemical signals involved in MOG pathophysiology is interleukin-6. So we are increasingly using interleukin-6 blocking drugs in the treatment of MOG. Perhaps we could also apply that same principle to the treatment of ADEM with or without MOG antibody. And the reality is we just don't know.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Gambale and Dr. Kanan to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on June 18th, uniQure reported that it aligned with the FDA, with the agency agreeing that the 3-year data from its phase 1-2 program of AMT-130 is sufficient as the primary basis for a planned biologics license application submission. According to the company, they are expecting to submit an application for the gene therapy product in Huntington disease in the third quarter of 2026. Next up, on the same day, Teva Pharmaceuticals announced the submission of a new drug application for its investigational agent ecopipam as a new treatment for Tourette syndrome. If approved, ecopipam would be the first FDA-approved treatment for Tourette syndrome in more than a decade and the first non-antipsychotic pharmacotherapy ever approved for the condition. And lastly, on June 22nd, both the FDA and EMA accepted regulatory applications for Regeneron's cemdisiran, an investigational siRNA for the treatment of adults who are AChR antibody positive generalized myasthenia gravis. If approved, cemdisiran would be the first siRNA agent indicated for GMG and the first complement targeting treatment available via subcutaneous quarterly dosing in this population. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Gambale and Dr. Kanan.
Yeah, I know we just saw the recent successful study for the METEOROID trial using satralizumab in MOGAD, which was obviously a pretty big deal, seeing the first phase 3 successful trial for MOGAD. So it'll be interesting to see how that crosses over with ADAM as well. You guys had also talked about the fact that this is a disorder that, you know, is typically kind of monophasic and that, you know, treatment and the clinical outlook kind of gets a little bit better over time. But let's just talk a little bit more about some of that long-term outlook. You know, what do we know about prognosis, relapse risk, and the types of neurologic or cognitive sequelae that patients may experience after recovery?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what's also thing sort of we kind of alluded to is that a lot of the ADEM literature is pre-MOGAD diagnosis and pre-MOGAD consistent criteria. So a lot of the ADEM literature we're going to have to sort of like revisit, because now that we know about MOGAD, I think a lot of the ADEM literature will change. But currently what we know is that generally ADEM is monophasic, so a one-time event. Recovery is pretty good, what we think, in terms of imaging generally resolves. Almost all the lesions resolve at least 3 months. And if they don't, then you have to go back and revisit. What do they have? Is there something else happening, for example, like a genetic cause? The other thing is that we think generally that people do pretty well over time, but there's a lot of newer studies looking at long-term outcomes. Now we're talking about 10, 15 years from the onset. So let's say the ADEM occurred in a child who was around age 5. Now we're looking at 10 years later when they're a teenager. Are they really relatively normal and are expected, you know, growth development? And it turns out a single inflammatory attack such as ADEM can affect long-term expected brain growth. So there's some data supporting that thalamic growth is smaller. So the thalamus, which is the middle part of the brain, everything goes through there, kind of like Grand Central Station, is smaller than what we expect. And there's some data to support that children had ADEM with a one-time attack during their younger years, during the time when their brain is growing. As they become older, school-age children, and getting into high school, that their grades may not be as good as they could have been because of the ADEM. So even though generally we tell families and patients like, oh, this is a one-time thing, generally you'll recover well, there's something about that one-time insult during the time of brain development that probably has some sequelae, not only with cognitive and schoolwork, but also things like ADHD and attention is something else that we see a lot. Again, hard to say, is it somebody who was predisposed to ADHD in the beginning and then this just tipped them over the edge versus would they have had it anyway? And that's a question we often can't answer. That's the prognosis. Relapse risk is very low. People say, you know, less than 5%. But again, I think with the MOGAD data, I think a lot of the recurrent ADEM or the multiphasic ADEM, as it used to be called, is probably a lot of MOG patients.
Yeah, we've obviously seen a lot more interest into the kind of MOGAD realm over the last couple of years. So it's interesting to hear kind of it potentially predating MOGAD per se. So, and obviously this is an area that we'll continue to see as more interest kind of comes into here. We'll continue to see it kind of evolve a little bit more over the next couple of years. I'm also curious, Dr. Kanaan, we talked a little bit about IL-6 for a quick second there. And you know, I'd have to obviously talk a little bit about biomarkers, which is a huge thing, you know, in the MS community, especially with the recent diagnostic criteria. But also we've seen more biomarkers come into play for obviously the other disorders like MOG and aquaporin 4 for NMOSD and whatnot. So talk a little bit about any emerging biomarkers or imaging approaches that may ultimately help improve diagnostic precision in the coming years.
Yeah, biomarkers are obviously a very hot topic for good reason. We're trying to improve the speed of diagnosis and the accuracy of diagnosis. I think MS is a good counterpoint to ADEM. The cool thing about the new MS criteria is that we have actually been able to diagnose people with MS before they've ever had clinical symptoms of MS, what we used to call radiologically isolated syndrome. But now applying those MRI tools, like looking for central vein sign and the paramagnetic rim, like Ray suggested, can actually allow somebody to get an official diagnosis of MS and start treatment before they ever have an attack and ideally prevent them from ever having disability. ADEM's trickier because we don't think that there is silent disease activity that necessarily precedes the onset of a very severe and pretty obvious clinical decline. So I think it's tough to make a pre-symptomatic diagnosis like we are now doing for MS. I think applying some of those same imaging tools might help us to distinguish ADEM lesions from other types of mimickers, including genetic disorders. Let's talk a little bit about cytokines. So cytokines, as a lot of us know, are the chemical messengers that lymphocytes and white blood cells use to communicate with each other. Interleukin-6 has gotten a lot of attention recently because we have drugs that are now in the pipeline to target IL-6 as a disease mechanism, which is really exciting. I think at this point in ADEM, serum and CSF cytokine testing is something that clinicians should consider, with the caveat that this is still kind of experimental. And oftentimes you're going to get conflicting results or results that don't quite make sense. Like a child might be extremely critically ill and look clinically and radiographically like they have ADEM, but their cytokine profile in the CSF might be surprisingly normal looking. We still don't quite know how to reconcile that, but I think it's okay to collect biomarkers in case you're in a situation like we've been here where kids have gotten plasma exchange and steroids and IVIG and they're still not getting better. Then if we do have evidence that IL-6 or something else is elevated, then that might give us a treatment avenue of something off-label and experimental, but worth talking about with the family to see if it's something worth trying in a life-threatening situation. The other thing that's gotten a lot of press and application in the MS world is neurofilament light chain, which is a protein that's in the axons themselves and is a pretty interesting, reliable biomarker of brain injury. It's not specific to MS, ADEM, or neuroimmune diseases. We see it elevated in Alzheimer's and traumatic brain injury and brain tumors. But if you know that there has been a brain injury, perhaps it has value in predicting what sort of recovery and outcome could be. And it might be something that's trendable over the time of the treatment course to see if it correlates with clinical improvement.
Yeah, I know the conversations for NFL have definitely sparked up over the last couple of years, especially in things like ALS, especially. We had the first approved drug that was based off of changes on neurofilament light. So I'm also curious, you know, you guys don't have a magic ball per se, but, you know, how do we kind of get more answers or try to, you know, identify patients before these attacks even happen? I know it's probably a big question within the clinical community, but what are some of the conversations that you guys are having amongst other clinicians on how we can potentially see these patients and potentially stop those attacks before they even happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's, again, going back to the MS literature, because there's more in that, there is data supporting that there's increased healthcare utilization in MS, even up to 5 to 10 years before their diagnosis. And so what I'm wondering, which again, this is just a out there idea, you know, could somebody use some sort of machine learning algorithm, for example, because now that we have AI machine learning tools that could sort of scope out saying, hey, this person has had increased health utilization in the past 5 to 10 years that matches these other people who have ended up diagnosed with MS. So then consider, again, can't diagnose somebody without all the proper techniques, but consider, could MS be a diagnosis? And the same thing I'm wondering for the ADEM world is, you know, we know that a lot of these people come up with ADEM, it's after having some sort of infection. So then, you know, did they have an infection plus, I'm making something up here, but maybe there's a genetic predisposition to autoimmune disease. Are they the ones more likely to get ADEM? But unfortunately, we don't have all the data or research to show like who's at increased risk for ADEM. So we probably need to start there of like, how can we identify who's at increased risk, which again, machine learning and AI could help us with that. And then at that point, could that algorithm then sort of help predict, okay, these people who come in with X, Y, and Z, maybe they're the ones who are more likely to develop it.
I mean, especially for a small population like the ADEM group, obviously machine learning and collective sharing of data is definitely going to be important to continue to advance treatment options and advance diagnostic strategies for this group. I appreciate both of you guys for taking some time out of your day. I have one last quick question for both of you. You know, for the clinical community, if you had to kind of give a call out and talk a little bit about maybe what misconceptions there are about ADEM, just talk a little bit about what some of those misconceptions might be amongst clinicians or even those who are kind of coming up the medical field right now. What are some things that they might get wrong at first about ADEM?
Yeah, this is something I struggled with as a trainee. For context, I started my intern year in pediatrics in 2017, which is the same year that most of us in the US had clinical access to MOG IgG testing. So we've very much been learning as we go, and it's been kind of the story of my medical training, I think. But I think we had a hard time reconciling that ADEM is kind of an umbrella term and that MOG antibody disease is a specific autoimmune disease and that ADEM can be a manifestation of MOG antibody disease. So they're not mutually exclusive. And like Grace used the analogy of a Venn diagram, MOG and ADEM definitely overlap a lot, but they have some distinctions as well. So there's a lot of kids and adults that have ADEM not related to MOG antibodies. And there's a lot of people that have MOG antibody disease that don't ever present with ADEM. They may just have optic neuritis or myelitis or something else. So again, I want to reiterate that because I found that very confusing for many years. But it's starting to, I think as a field, we're getting a little bit more clarity on how these diagnostic categories fit in with each other. The last thing I'd want to say is, again, mimics are really common, especially in young children. We really want to be on the lookout for things like leukodystrophies and metabolic disorders, mitochondrial disorders. And, you know, a radiologist isn't there at bedside. They take a look at an MRI and they correctly say that this is a pattern that looks a certain way. And one of the things on the differential that can look like this is ADEM. But it's up to us, the clinicians who are there with the patient, to correlate that with the time course and the exam and to decide, do we think this is ADEM or do we think that this is something that radiographically looks like ADEM, but is actually something else entirely?
Yeah, I agree with that. And a couple of things I would add is, you know, just like everything we do in neurology and in medicine, if a patient doesn't fit the clinical picture, go back to the drawing board, make sure you have the correct diagnosis. If you have somebody who you think has ADEM, but 3 months later has the persistent lesions, like Dr. Conan was talking about earlier, this is not ADEM. So make sure you're going back to drawing board and like trying to figure out what it is. A couple other diagnoses I would put a plug in for would be things like CNS HLH, for example. So that's where you have HLH just restricted to the brain. They don't have the systemic manifestations of HLH with all the crazy cytopenias and liver enzyme abnormalities and cholesterol abnormalities. And it's just in the brain. And that's usually a genetic disorder. And the treatment for that is very different because treatment for that is actually bone marrow transplant. It's not your usual steroids, IVIG, plasma exchange, right? A lot of inflammatory diseases, you can probably get by with using a lot of the same treatments for everybody. There's a few exceptions to that. But generally, right, everyone gets steroids, plasma exchange, and or IVIG. IL-6 inhibitors probably helpful across the board, although less evidence in MS. The CD20 monoclonal antibodies. There's a lot of treatments that overlap amongst the diseases. But things like CNS HLH, it is steroid responsive and refractory, meaning that as you wean steroids, the symptoms will come back or the lesions will get worse again. And so people will think it's some sort of inflammatory thing that can be treated by inflammatory medications with actually treatments very different. So just making sure that going back to the drawing board if the patient's not fitting the clinical diagnosis.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.